This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, welcome. I'm Cassie Huff. This is the South Australian Country Hour. Now, November has delivered more rain than the rest of the year combined virtually for some parts of the state. It's been a huge blow for grain and horticulture producers, but graziers in the north of the state are daring to think that the drought might come to an end.
It's a huge bonus for us. We were coming into summer with a lot of dams going dry. We'd really had no rains of any consequence since October last year, and a lot of the smaller dams were starting to bite the dust. So now to be able to have every dam full and swamps full, yeah, it's a huge relief.
I'll have more on where some welcome rain has fallen soon, and some new research could debunk the idea that native vegetation next to crops provides a safe haven for snails. But first up today, if you are cleaning up after the big storms last month, applications that open today for grants of up to $10,000 to help with cleanup costs. The storm cell brought heavy rain, strong winds and hail to the Riverland, Murraylands and Barossa. Minister for Primary Industries David Basham gives Viktor Petrovic the details.
So yes, it's very pleasing we're able to announce that people who suffered storm damage and need to do some cleanup after that damage on primary production properties are able to get access to up to $10,000 grants that the state and federal governments have put in place.
So is this just for the storm that occurred on October the 28th, or is this storm support available to producers affected by the storm on November the 6th as well?
This is a target at the storm on the 28th, but understanding it'll be very difficult in many cases to distinguish when the damage necessarily occurred. So I encourage people to apply in relation to that.
So is there future support packages that we can look out for that might be aimed at that second storm, or is this it for now?
This is it for now. We're certainly working towards the damage that was made on that 28th right across the state. That was the application that we're able to get agreement on, but I do understand that it'll be very difficult for many people in the Riverland to distinguish between when the damage actually occurred.
Has the figure of $10,000 been decided upon based on those assessments PIRSA has been conducting since the storms?
The $10,000 amount is something that is standard with these storm events. That it's an agreement between the state and the federal governments right across the nation that this be the response. And so once the state makes application based on the survey amounts of damage, it triggers the process to be evaluated by the federal government, and the federal government agreed on Friday that they would support us in matching funds for those suffering that damage.
Do you think that $10,000 will be enough for some farmers who've had significant damage and crop loss?
It's certainly there to cover the cleanup. Understand that there's been widespread damage. This isn't there to cover that damage as such. There's opportunities in some cases for crop insurance and all those sorts of things to cover the damage. This is very much to cover the cleanup and get people back into production.
Oh, okay. So this is mainly for the cleanup. It's not for crop losses, is that right?
That's right. It's for the cleanup. It doesn't necessarily have to. It could be things like extra prunings and things that might be needed to actually bring the crops back into production. But it's certainly about cleanup rather than crop damage as such.
Are PIRSA assessments still ongoing for the recent storms affecting the Barossa, Murraylands and Riverland?
My understanding is that the survey may have concluded on Friday, and so if there are people that haven't got that information in but still wish to get that information, I would suggest they contact PIRSA directly rather than trying to find a survey necessarily on websites, etc.
And on the PIRSA website, it says the eligibility criteria will be released soon. Do you know when that will be?
My understanding is that it'll be available today, being Monday, for people to make those applications. So forms will be up there allowing people to apply as of Monday today.
How do people apply?
I direct them to the website. It's probably the easiest way to just go to the CURSA website to find the link through to the application forms would be the simplest way, or a telephone call into CURSA for assistance to find it.
Minister for Primary Industries David Basham speaking with Victor Petrovich. Now, rain has obviously caused issues for harvest and the storms have done a huge amount of damage, as was alluded to there. But in the outback, people are daring to hope that for some, the drought may be close to over. Cole Greenfield is a pastoralist at Billikalina Station near Roxby Downs, and he's received 44 millimetres at their Billikalina homestead and 125 mils at their Millers Creek Station property. Mr. Greenfield says that a month ago his property was looking dry, but now he's confident he's set for summer.
Yeah, extensive flooding. It wasn't, because it was just steady, constant rain, it wasn't like a really heavy thunderstorm in an hour, so the water had a bit of a chance to get away, but there was just sheets of water for miles, and there's a very big flood coming down the Millers Creek at the moment as a result.
And what have you been hearing from your neighbours and other people around the pastoral areas?
Well, I think probably for the whole of November now, most people have got some sort of relief. Some may not have got too good rains, but a lot of people have got some storms or something somewhere now that they've got a few moves going into summer.
And I suppose how significant is this break and is this additional rain for you?
Yeah, well, having a follow-up in the warmer weather, like 2 weeks apart, it's pretty much textbook to be able to get that initial growth and then another really good rain on top. And a good, like, even though it was over 24 hours, but it was a good soaking rain that sank in. So subsoil moisture will be very good. And then, the added bonus is the flood out in your creeks and swamps.
How significant is this going to be in terms of being able to keep on more stock and produce more feed as well?
Yeah, well, it's a huge bonus for us. We were coming into summer with a lot of dams going dry. We'd really had no rains of any consequence since October last year, and a lot of the smaller dams were starting to bite the dust. It was looking like being a pretty ordinary summer with really only 1 year of relief after three exceptionally dry years. So now to be able to have every dam full and swamps full, it's a huge relief going forward. Like it's pretty much the summer. Doesn't really matter what happens now, we'll be right.
Does it affect your Christmas plans as well?
It makes them a lot more relaxing. Probably helps the local bottler a fair bit more. There'll be some fairly serious damage to the dog fence, I reckon, in places, but that's as expected. And the rebuild's going on at the moment, which with some realignments will help with that problem going forward. But no, it's really a... There's just all positives, really.
Billikalina Station pastoralist Cole Greenfield speaking there. Wooltanna Station is roughly 500 kilometres east of Billikalina on Lake Frome. Pastoralist Anna Nunn says the recent rains have been a huge weight off their shoulders and a big relief for their neighbours too.
Everyone's had a pretty widespread rain for this side of the Flinders Ranges, from Yunta right up to Mullawatna towards like the Innaminka side of things. So hopefully, it's been widespread, which it hasn't been before. We've only had sort of localised thunderstorm bits in areas, which, is good for a little bit of feed in areas, but we needed that real widespread rain to really kick things off.
How significant has that been for your property and your business?
This rainfall's been a follow-up rain from 15 mils on the 11th of November, and we also had 18 mils on the 10th of October, so it's a perfect follow-up rain after, 4 or 5 years of no decent rains. It's allowed the ground to start soaking and germinating, and then a big fall without washing everything away is going to lead us into a pretty, hopefully, wet summer. But, there'll be feed around.
How challenging have the past 4 or 5 years been out there?
This whole area's been in pretty severe drought. There's been very below average rainfalls for the whole area. So a rainfall like this after a few smaller rainfalls is, yes, season changing, I guess, and hopefully now pointing this whole area in the right direction of a bit more regular rainfall.
Would you say this means that you're out of drought just yet?
I don't know if it was the drought breaker, but hopefully with a few follow-up rains, we'll be able to say it's over.
Pultana Station's Anna Nunn ending that story from Lucas Forbes. Now, graziers in the southwest of New South Wales are also smiling after good rains fell there as well last week. At Carstairs Station, 20 kilometres south of Pooncarie, the dams are also full and they'll be fed for sheep for at least 12 months. Gary Cullinan says it's a great early Christmas present.
We had 94 mils at the house on the river, and we've been around the paddock today and we measured 9 rain gauges, and yeah, they were from 110 up to 127 mils.
So that's a fair bit of variability.
So yeah, most of the gauges, I think about 5 of them had around 120 mils in them.
Have your neighbours fared as well?
I haven't been talking to them all, but the one just north of us had about the same on the river, but I'm not sure out the back.
It seems phenomenal given that here in Mildura, there wouldn't even have been enough rain to justify tipping out a rain gauge. So do people down further south seem really surprised at just how wet it's been?
Yeah, I was in Mildura myself. So it was, when we come home, it was a bit of a surprise. We'd had about 70-odd mil, and then it just kept raining, and we finished up with 94 last night, so it was good.
And when you get that much rain within a matter of days, what does your property look like?
A lot of it just soaks away, but all the dams are full, and there's water just laying in swamps that we haven't seen for a long time, and a few fence lines and roads underwater, and a few roads going to need repairing, but that's all good.
When was the last time you would have had this much rain out your way?
Been going through the records today, and you'd have to go back to January 2011. We had 197 mils over 4 days, and then 3 weeks later we had 125 mil. Got to go back a fair way. We had good rains in 2012 as well, but not as much as we've had the last 2 days.
And were you telling me that your sons, who are in their 20s, have seen water in places on the farm now that they've never seen before?
Yeah, they haven't seen it. There's some spots there's probably as much water as we had in February 2000. The boys have not seen it as full in a few swamps. They're a bit excited this morning and roaring around on the bikes.
You've got Dorpers and white Dorper sheep. How are they coping with all the wet weather at the moment?
They go good. Coping real good. So be just a problem. They'll probably get overfat now, but we'll take that after the last few years. So,
was there a risk that they could have got bogged in that much rain?
No, our country's like pretty sandy, so they can get out of it. It's just more probably on the river country, but yeah, we haven't found anything that's been stuck. It sort of rained over 2 days, so yeah, they can get out of it. We'll get feed now for a good 12 months or more, and if we get more rain, it'll really bulk the country up. We sort of had up to 300 and something mils already this year, so we're only in a 250 average, so the country's looking magnificent.
Gary Cullinan from Carstairs Station, which is 20 kilometres south of Pooncarie, speaking with Kelly Hollingworth about some rain that they've had. They average 250 millimetres of rain a year, and they've received between 94 and 125 millimetres over 2 days across their property. So it's a fair slab of rain for such a low rainfall area. So as he was saying there, it's good news heading into summer. It's 19 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now to the York Peninsula, and new research could debunk the idea that native vegetation next to crops provides a safe haven for snails. Northern and York Landscape Board ecologist Dr. Michael Nash has been studying the snails' movements using time-lapse cameras near Warooga and Marion Bay. Now Dr. Nash says the high-quality native vegetation could actually help control snail numbers.
Native vegetation that doesn't harbour exotic grasses also does not harbour snails, so can provide ecosystem services to the surrounding productive landscapes. With the introducing of a parasitoid fly from overseas to control exotic snails, it has been found that these flies need floral resources or pollen to improve their ability to lay eggs inside snails. So maintaining vegetation also provides a resource for these parasitoid flies to control, in particular conical snails for which they've been released to control.
So how does that finding come up against, I suppose, what you think a lot of farmers suspect about native vegetation next to crops?
Generally, it's considered poor quality vegetation next to crops has been considered as a source of pests in the past, and snails are thought to move from these poor quality areas into crops in the autumn. But then there's not much known about snails moving back out of crops and what the triggers are for that and what sorts of vegetation they move back into to survive over the summer. By addressing a lack of knowledge of snail movement and understanding the types of vegetation snails move to and from, we can provide growers with management guidelines on how to maintain better quality vegetation, in particular native vegetation, surrounding their crops so that these don't provide a refuge for snails over the summer for them to then reinvade crops when the crop's growing the following winter.
So what sort of native vegetation should farmers be trying to encourage the growth of?
What their forebears have very thoughtfully left behind, particularly on southern York Peninsula, the areas of mallee that have been left behind that are still homes to mallee fowl on private land and things like that. It's mainly trying to maintain those areas free of exotic weeds, in particular grasses, which seem to be the harbour for snails as well, is what we're finding.
And you mentioned flies which lay their eggs in snails before. How long have those flies been on the York Peninsula?
So they were imported in the early 2000s by CSIRO and SARDI, and then intensive releases at nursery sites, I think it was up until about 2003-2004, saw the establishment of these sarcophagid flies. And for a while, they was considered they hadn't established. But then more recent research funded by the Grains Research and Development Corporation has shown they have established. And the latest work that's now come out of SARDI has shown that these flies do parasitise conical snails, particularly on farms where there are patches of native vegetation still remaining. New technology is fantastic. The cameras are giving us real-time data on what's actually happening and what's going on at the edges, and with the snails in particular that stay above ground and very visual, they're a wonderful tool to build on previous knowledge that demonstrated some movement. This gives us real-time information. So technology's enabled us, along with the funding from the NRM body, to really start to get a handle on what's happening on the edges of farmers' paddocks.
Northern and York Landscape Board ecologist Dr. Michael Nash speaking with Lucas Forbes. Now, it's warming up. It finally feels a bit like spring now after what's been a very cool spring across South Australia. So to find out what's happening weather-wise this week, the Bureau of Meteorology is with us. Senior forecaster Tom Bowick has the details. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
So, it's warming up across the state. What's happening?
Yes, certainly. Looking at the temperatures even now, much of the state, the temperatures are in the sort of high 20s, even getting to the low 30s in the far north there. And the reason for that is we have this high pressure system over the Tasman Sea area, and winds are quite overland. It's also dry conditions as well. So, not expecting any precipitation around for today throughout the state. Now, as we move into Tuesday, it's also going to be largely a dry day, still going to be mostly under the influence of that high pressure system. The only sort of slight exception there is a bit of moisture just coming into the far northeast of the state there. Could just see a chance of a shower or thunderstorm in the afternoon, but we're talking about the very far sort of northeastern part of the state there. For the remainder, it will be dry throughout, and temperatures will be on the increase from what they get to today. So warm to hot temperatures are expected throughout, and there'll be some moderate to fresh northerly winds coming into the west of the state. There is a weak change going to be impinging on the far west later on Tuesday, associated with a trough feature moving across from the west, which you'll see winds shifting around to moderate to fresh southerly. Now, on Wednesday, that trough feature will be moving eastwards. It's going to be largely dry weather associated with the trough, but in the east of the state, some of that moisture will be coming in a little bit further into eastern districts. So we're thinking of a slight chance of showers and possible thunderstorms to be developing for areas to the east of the Flinders and Mount Lofty ranges. Temperature-wise, it will be mild to warm about the southern and western coasts, but grading to hot in the north and very hot in the far north, so getting into the sort of low 40s regions in the far north there. And winds will be light to moderate northeast to northwesterly, but there will be associated with the trough a southwest to southeasterly change extending across the west and south. Then on as we move into Thursday, then I still got some weather in the associated with sort of coming from the northeast there, so a slight chance of a shower, possible thunderstorm for the northern agricultural area and the pastoral districts, but all to the southeast of about Lee Creek. We've got very hot conditions in the far north still, so those low 40s temperatures will be persisting in the far north with moderate fresh northeast to northerly winds. And further to the south, it'll be mild near the coasts, grading to warm to hot inland, and the winds will be moderate to fresh southwest to southeasterly. Then on Friday, a little bit more general chance of some shower activity, but still not a lot around, so a slight chance of showers, except for the far north and also over the southeast of the state. We also have a chance of a thunderstorm for the northeast pastoral district. And temperature-wise, some of those milder temperatures are starting to push a little bit further inland as a strong high-pressure system develops to the southwest of the Bight there. So mild conditions expected about the coasts with a moderate to fresh southwest to southeasterly airstream. Still very hot in the far north where the winds will be persisting as light northerlies. Now, for the weekend period and for Monday, so Saturday, Sunday, Monday there, we've got dry conditions apart from a slight chance of some showers and possible thunderstorms in the far north, so that high to the south will be pushing some of that dry area a bit further north, pushing the weather up into the northern parts of the state. It'll be mild in the south, grading to hot in the far north. Now, just to finish off the rainfall totals, so we're not expecting a great deal. There may be some higher rainfalls with thunderstorms, isolated thunderstorms, but generally until midnight Friday, expecting any rainfall to be less than 2 millimetres, except for the far north and southeast of the state, where not expecting any rainfall at all. With the thunderstorm activity, not many falls of this amount, but a chance of some falls up to 10 millimetres possible with those thunderstorms. So it's back to you, Cassie.
Thanks for that. Tom Bowick from the Bureau of Meteorology there. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be partly cloudy tomorrow. There is a very high chance of showers, though, in the east. Medium chance elsewhere, but there could be some storms around, possibly even quite heavy in the east as well. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 18 to 21 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach 26 to 33 degrees. The lower western, similar situation. It's partly cloudy there tomorrow as well. There is a high chance of showers showers in the northeast, but only a slight chance elsewhere. There could be a thunderstorm around there as well. Overnight temperatures will get down to 16 to 19, but the daytime temperatures will reach around 30 degrees. I'm Cassie Huff. You're listening to The Country Hour. We've got more to come as it is coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Good afternoon. I'm so glad you could join me on this rather warm day across South Australia and into Broken Hill. It's been a year. Can you believe it? Since China whacked on tariffs in excess of 200% in some cases on Australian wine. And now the figures are stark, showing trade with China has dropped by $1 billion. But despite the pandemic and some shipping issues, the industry is diversifying.
It's tough with COVID because you can't get overseas and you can't shake hands and introduce yourself and get them tasting your wines and making those relationships, I guess, or growing those relationships. Having said that, we've seen some good shoots in Japan.
Not just Japan. Southeast Asia is proving to be quite interested in picking up some of the wine that is no longer going to China. And I dare say you have as well. Have you noticed that there might be some cheaper wines on the shelves now, wines you perhaps hadn't seen before because they were going overseas, or are things pretty similar? Let me know. 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. I'd be interested to see what you've noticed about the changes to the wine industry a year on since China imposed those huge tariffs on Australian wine. Also, you'll meet a group of passionate rail supporters who are rallying to have rail transport started back up on the Eyre Peninsula. That's coming up in the next half hour, but first to the news with Emma Rebelato. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. The Northern Territory has recorded its first case of the Omicron variant of COVID-19. A man in his 30s tested positive while in quarantine from a repatriation flight from Johannesburg. The new variant has now been found in more than 10 countries, and Canada is one of the latest. Omicron was first detected in southern Africa, and many countries have since introduced travel bans to contain the spread. ACOS and the University of New South Wales have looked at the impact of the pandemic on housing affordability. Their study shows Australian renters on low incomes are struggling as rents soar and social housing fails to keep up with demand. And the NBL is taking a leaf out of the NBA's playbook. It's introducing what's called a coach's challenge this season, which starts Friday. It means each team is entitled to one coach's challenge per game on fouls or out-of-bound calls, and they can keep challenging until it's unsuccessful. We'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Emma. Now, as I was saying, it's been a year since China imposed anti-dumping duties on Australian wine imports. Since then, $1 billion worth of exports to China have been wiped from the balance sheet. This time last year, Jared Stringer from the Lane Wine Company in the Adelaide Hills was exporting more than 20,000 bottles a year to China. Now, not a drop as these anti-dumping duties, some in excess of 200%, have taken hold.
All of that wine going to China had to end up somewhere, and my biggest concern was and still is that it would end up in the domestic market and thus flooding it and lowering the price.
At its peak, the Chinese wine trade was worth $1.26 billion a year to Australia. It made up 41% of the overall value of Australian wine exports globally. In the past 12 months, that trade has fallen off a cliff. It's now worth just $82 million. The domestic market has picked up some of the homeless wine, but Wine Australia's export figures show a $1 billion drop in wine sold to China has not been covered by other buyers. Exports to new or expanding markets have only increased by 10% in value to $1.99 billion and decreased by 6% in volume to 610 million litres. Market diversification has been the main strategy to turn the fortunes around. The federal government put together a $50 million export and regional wine support package. But the pandemic, as well as tight container availability and a global shipping crisis, has made developing new markets difficult. The UK has emerged as the largest market now by volume and value for Australian wine, and it's one the Lane has targeted.
So it's a completely different market in that the UK is not buying the same sort of high-level premium wines that China was buying. So we're having to sell less volume at a lower price, essentially, to the UK. While we do still sell some great wines in the UK, certainly not in the same volume as China was buying. So we're having to educate, hopefully, the UK consumers a little bit more that they can buy some pretty premium Australian wines. But that's, you know, when you think about some of the discounted wines they've been buying for a long time through Tesco's and Sainsbury's and those big supermarkets, yeah, it's a little bit of a re-education program, I think. It's tough with COVID. You can't get overseas and you can't shake hands and introduce yourself and get them tasting your wines and making those relationships, I guess, or growing those relationships. Having said that, we've seen some good shoots in Japan. Again, it's not going to be a high volume market, but certainly very high end market. The Japanese market are looking for wines with a high retail value that can go into their high end restaurants, and their consumers are quite receptive to that. So that's been quite positive. But we're also looking through Southeast Asia. The other good thing about growing Southeast Asia is it's a far easier market for Australians to service.
And the numbers back that up. Wine Australia's General Manager of Corporate Affairs and Regulation, Rachel Triggs, says there are some promising signs, particularly in Southeast Asia.
There's been some upkick in markets such as Singapore, South Korea, Hong Kong, Thailand and Taiwan. So Hong Kong, for example, in the last 12 months is up 120% to $206 million. Singapore's up 89% to $164 million. South Korea's been a really strong market in the last 12 months, so up 84% to $46 million. And both Thailand and Taiwan have experienced growth of about 50%, and they're both now sitting at $27 million. So some pretty positive signs in those other Asian markets where they do tend to prefer premium red wine.
The premium red wines have felt the brunt of the tariffs, with 96% of the wine sold to China red wine. South Australian Wine Industry Association Chief Executive Brian Smedley says there are significant headwinds heading into the 2022 vintage.
So for bottled wine, it means that for the last year it's been gradually progressively ending. For many producers, they are looking for alternative varieties, and we know for grape growers that there are contracts that have been made that are now being unmade, in the sense that they supply intakes are being looked at ahead of the vintage 2022. And we also know that pricing has come off for red grapes in particular, given that China was a red grape market. We're looking at alternative markets, but those alternative markets will take a long time to come on, and it won't necessarily replace the value or the volume that has been going to China in the past.
The World Trade Organization will form a panel to investigate the dumping allegations by China, but it will take some time before it will make any findings. Until then, exporters like Jared Stringer are bracing for more tough times ahead, but with hope for new markets.
We're still optimistic. I think, there's strength in adversity. You know, we're able to come out of this a bit stronger. And I think that's the same with a lot of markets, particularly agricultural markets, where, you're thrown pretty much everything, including the weather, at you. And we're a pretty resilient bunch in the wine industry. You know, we've gone through lots of different phases, growth and retraction. And, this is just another one of those.
Jared Stringer, CEO of The Lane, with a bit of a glass half full outlook to what could be some more tough times for the Australian grape and wine industry to come. Hopefully new markets come up and the shipping crisis can alleviate to allow more opportunity to get into new markets. Be interested to know, though, if you've noticed different wines, cheaper wines on the shelf compared to a year ago. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. From wine to milk now, and Coles has lifted the price of its cheap wine by 10 cents a litre, matching the increase by Woolworths last week. Consumers will now pay $2.60 for 2 litres of Coles home brand milk, $3.90 for 3 litres, and $1.35 for the single litre. But it's still 20 cents short of the $1.50 a litre the industry is calling for from supermarkets. Kim Honan is speaking here with Graham Forbes from advocacy group Dairy Connect about the Coles increase.
Yes, I know it's good news, and this is what's happened every other time. Woolworths has gone first, and Coles has immediately responded. So, it's a good result. But certainly, we're going to need some, hopefully we can get another one for the farmers, because I think this one will be soaked up within the industry, and farmers are seeing really high inflation at the moment. We're seeing our grain costs, fertiliser, fuel costs, plus machinery costs just going through the roof, huge cost rises.
Well, since the news of the Woolworths lift last week, a lot of people have been saying that they're happy to pay the extra 10 cents a litre as long as it goes back to the farmer. Do we know whether it's actually going to go back to the farmer, this 10 cents lift?
I don't think it will directly go back to the farmer this time. But, it's regardless of whether it directly or indirectly comes back to the farmer, it gives the rest of the industry the opportunity to lift their prices and look, all the branded prices and all the other products, last time we had two lots of 10 cent rises together, and we've always said we need to get it up to $1.50 a litre. So we've still got a bit of a way to go there. So, until we can get it around that $1.50 a litre at the moment, things are going to struggle. And I think that's got to give farmers confidence to reinvest back in the industry. And we're seeing a bit of a struggle there still, that farmers are steadily fixing up their fences and a few things, but they need to have a better price to be able to make those long-term investments to build new dairies and buy farms, etc.
Well, it's taken more than 2 years for this 10 cent lift per litre. It could take some while to get that other 20 cents to get it up to $1.50.
Well, I think we saw two lots of 10 cents before, and I think there'll be pressure on, and let's hope the consumer can accept that, and because it needs to happen in 2 years. Like I've said just recently, we've seen this really high inflation, and if we don't see that return coming back to the farmers in one way or another, we'll see the industry continue to contract.
Well, Norco supplies Coles milk for its home brand milk. You're a Norco supplier. Do you think Norco should be sending that 10 cent a litre lift on?
Well, I think that's a discussion between Norco and Coles. And certainly, there's a very strong case from the huge inflation. I know that was brought up at the Norco AGM and other meetings, that farmers are really concerned about the inflationary costs that are hitting us at the moment.
So I should say, when I say, should Norco send that 10 cents a litre on to farmers, is Coles going to send that extra 10 cents a litre on to Norco?
That's up to, that's the discussion, like I said, between the processor and Coles. But I think, there's a very strong case there to be put forward to Coles regarding farmer prices. But unfortunately, we still haven't seen this market failure corrected. The farmers have no direct way of engaging with the supermarkets to get prices to flow directly back to them. We saw with the levy. But unless they come up with an increase in the levy, that's about the only way that the farmers can negotiate with the supermarkets. But, that system needs to improve.
Graham Forbes, president of Dairy Connect's Farmer Group and a Norco supplier from Barrington near Gloucester. And Coles and Norco have been contacted for comment on what suppliers will see of the 10 cent a litre increase. Now, it's been a hot topic in South Australia for some time now, and Federal Resources Minister Keith Pitt has formally selected a property on the Eyre Peninsula to store Australia's low and medium level radioactive waste. The government has already announced the facility would be built at Nepandi near Kimber, and today officially declared it the chosen site. It would store waste currently kept at more than 100 sites across the country, and mostly comes from nuclear medicine. The declaration opens the door, though, to a legal challenge from traditional owners who say they were left out of the consultation process. Emma Pedler is speaking here with the Federal Resources Minister Keith Pitt about how this formal declaration progresses the project.
So the intention to declare provides a 60-day period for those with rights and interests to put forward their views. And I've considered those pieces of correspondence and everything else that's come into us. And this is still the right decision at the right site. It's certainly got all of the right geological requirements. We have support from the local community, or majority support from the local community. And we should never forget that this has taken 40 years, might have been some 16 ministers, but fundamentally for the local community of Kimber. It's been over 6 years of consultation. They're the most informed community in the country.
Some bungalow traditional owners have said they do not want the facility on this land. What consideration was given to their concerns?
Well, I've met with bungalow people twice, and my predecessor has done a lot of work as well in terms of portfolio. And as I've said, this has taken 6 years. There has been opportunities to work with the department. We've had submissions put forward from BDAC, from the Bungle people as well. And, of course, we consider what their issues and concerns are. The site itself doesn't have any native title. There is native title in some of the surrounding areas. So, of course, we'll work through the normal processes as we proceed.
The Bungle Determination Aboriginal Corporation, as you said, BDAC, they said back in August that if you declared Nepandi as the site, that it was going to bring a judicial review. What will that mean for your plans?
Well, I mean, that's a matter for them. My decisions are based around the national interest, what's required for all of the Australian people. And we've had advice recently from ANSTO that every single Australian will utilise nuclear medicine in their lifetime. Now, if we are going to use this technology, it produces low-level radioactive waste, and we have to deal with it and store with it. This is the best option on the table. This process has been a six-year iteration, and we've worked quite closely with the community and all interested stakeholders. But it's the right decision, and we need to get on with it now. This is a facility that will last for more than 100 years, and it's important for the country.
Federal Resources Minister Keith Pitt speaking to Emma Pedler there. And the Country Hour will be broadcasting from the Eyre Peninsula for the rest of the week. We'll be in Kimber on Wednesday. So we might touch base with how locals are feeling about this official declaration now that that area will be the chosen site to house Australia's low and medium level radioactive waste. So do tune in. Be great to have you on the road trip with Brooke Neindorf and I. It is 14 minutes to one.
If you've been through a disaster, like an earthquake, a fire or flood, you'll know they're overwhelming. I'm Dr. Kate Brady, and I work with communities after emergencies and research what happens in the months and years after these events. Join me for After the Disaster, a podcast to help you find your way through and beyond these life-changing moments.
Most people who are not in the community don't really understand the experience of disaster.
Find it on the ABC Listen app, the ABC Emergency website, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Serious injury claims are on the rise across Australian agriculture, continuing half a decade of stalled progress in workplace safety as primary industries keep their place as the most dangerous in Australia. Safe Work Australia has released workers' compensation stats for 2019-2020 financial year, and the numbers show agriculture, forestry and fishing are the most dangerous industries in Australia, well ahead of mining, construction and manufacturing. James Cook University Professor Richard Franklin says the workers' comp figures are actually underestimating the problem.
Look, I'm not surprised. I'm somewhat disappointed in the numbers. I mean, the numbers have been the same over the last probably 5 or 6 years with very little change in what we're seeing. And we know that agriculture is a dynamic and changing workplace. And so there are inherent risks in what you're doing. But you still, when we look at it, it is one of the most dangerous industries to work in. And so there's a lot of work that we need to do to make sure that we keep people safe so that they come home at night to their loved ones. So not surprised, but as I said, a bit disappointed. And I think there are some things that obviously we can work towards doing and making sure we do a better job at trying to keep everybody in the workplace safe.
These numbers refer specifically to workplace injury claims. To what extent does that capture an accurate picture of just how dangerous the workplace is in agriculture in Australia?
Yeah, it's not a very good representation. It covers about 60% of the people in agriculture. It's one of the lowest industries that are covered under the workers' compensation sort of scheme. We've got a lot of small and medium-sized enterprise with a lot of self-employed people, so they don't come under that scheme. So when you look at it, it's actually an underrepresentation from a numbers perspective. And that's one of the things that's a bit worrying when you look at it, that the numbers are still pretty high considering that we aren't including everybody. There is a bit of a skew when you look at it towards a younger cohort. We tend to find that as people get a bit older in agriculture, they do go out on their own and start up their own businesses. They're not super accurate, but what it does say is that, you know, we do have some challenges for us in agriculture around what we need to do to try and keep people safe and make sure that people don't get injured while they're working.
The numbers of instances of workplace injury have actually risen slightly since 2017 in Australian ag. Are the strategies that we're pursuing in order to mitigate those injuries just not working? Why is it that we've stalled in this way?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I mean, if you look back about 20 years ago to the late 90s, early 2000s, we've kind of reduced it by about a third from what we're seeing there. But certainly the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, it's really plateaued and we haven't seen much change in it. That probably says to me that some of the low-hanging fruit, you know, we've got in and managed to address some of those issues, but there's a lot of things that we still need to do and keep people safe as part of the process. And I'm kind of hoping that we're starting to think about, you know, we talk about the hierarchy of control, so eliminating some of the risks, but really thinking about a total risk-based approach to your workplace and not just workplace health and safety being an add-on. I certainly think that, you know, as we moved into some of the changes in the harmonisation, the legislation, that got the jurisdictions thinking about we need to do more around agriculture and people started to focus in on it. But obviously a lot more work to be done to make sure that people are safe and not being injured. And again, when we talk about the workers' comp stuff, it is really a particular group of people that go in. So one, you've got to be covered under the scheme. But secondly, you've got to reach a certain threshold, i.e. that there's got to be a cost of, you've got to spend more than 10 days off work to actually then be included in that. So, you know, it really is concerning. And it's concerning that unlike other areas where we're seeing a bit of a downward trend, we've stagnated in the agricultural sector.
What do you suppose the implications are of the additional stress that many farmers may be under this year in particular?
My guess is that we're going to see more people being injured. People will be working longer hours because they just don't have the labour to get onto the property and help out. There'll be a lot of people that previously would have just been providing sort of a management role that'll be doing two roles, so i.e. doing their management and also bringing in the crop. So my suspicion is that we're going to see more people injured. We may not see that in the workers' comp stuff because the people that are likely to be doing more work are those that own the property and those that are not covered under the workers' comp scheme. So it is a real concern and, you know, a big call out to keep an eye out for fatigue and make sure that you're putting some really good strategies in place to don't end up being killed or having a significant injury, which can then totally derail you getting the crop off.
When the strategy is undertaken of, you know, regulating our way to improved safety, there is a certain amount of resistance. The example that comes to mind for me is the regulations associated with quad bikes only a few weeks ago. That wasn't necessarily received well by a lot of farmers, and the same might be said for a lot of other regulations associated with improved safety. Where do you think the benefits are to be found, given that people don't necessarily want to change their practices or their tools, and those tools and practices might be dangerous to a certain extent?
Yeah, look, I think this is the million-dollar question for us. And what you're talking about there is how do we improve the culture around safety so that, you know, people are thinking about it and it's at the forefront of their mind. And I'm with you. I mean, I think that regulation can only go so far. And I think one of the things that we've got to make sure that we do when we regulate is that people understand why that regulation's in place, what the need for it is, and that they've got the tools to be able to deal with and address that. And often, you know, we see people trying to cut corners, and I get it. You know, you want to do things faster, you want to get the crop off, and that may then lead to consequences as part of that process. So again, for me, regulation's only one part of the story. I don't think you can ever regulate your way out of any situation if people aren't aware of it, people don't know what to do, and if people are only turning up after the event, that's not a preventative kind of solution. But we do need to be able to change behaviour, and that's one of the tools that are there. It's challenging. And as I said, I think some of the easy stuff has been done. We now need to think about culture and we now need to think about the way that we work and the systems that we put in place to try and keep people safe.
James Cook University Professor Richard Franklin, an expert in farm safety. And he was speaking with Angus McIntosh about the latest workers' compensation figures from Safe Work Australia. And you can read more about those numbers on the ABC Rural website. There's a lot of information there at abc.net.au/rural.
Finally today, a group of passionate rail supporters are rallying to have rail transport started back up on the Eyre Peninsula. A meeting was held yesterday in Port Lincoln, which saw about 70 people hear from members of the South Australian Transport Action Group, along with other speakers. Mari Shaw QC grew up near Locke and still owns farming land in the area. She says she's helping lead the charge to get rail back to the EP, not just for grain, but to help keep rural communities back on track as well.
It started when I went to a meeting at Locke where the community was gathering because there was grave concern that the community was dying. The supermarket had closed, the school's numbers were dwindling. And I noticed that the rail had closed as well, and I started to investigate how that happened. And what struck me was that I spoke to people from Elliston, Cummins, Woodner and Locke, and we got together and had a chat. It was plain that there were jobs to go on the peninsula, but they couldn't get people over here to fill them. And one of the major reasons was there was no accommodation, no investment infrastructure. And so Viterra have 6 to 8 jobs at every one of these silos they need to fill. In other words, the peninsula is an economic boom, but it does not have any investment infrastructure. And so it struck me that here we are, as I was driving up there, the roads were bordering on dangerous. There was roadworks which was only going to address shoulders. There was no overtaking. And the number of trucks that was essentially forced to go on the roads with the closure of the rail was going to damage the roads even further. And so I did some research of my own and realised that in the eastern states there'd been a CSIRO report in December 2020 that had costed out the cost of transport compared to roads, regional rail from Melbourne through Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland. And they were going to build a $15 billion inland rail precisely for the needs that Eyre Peninsula has, if you like. And they'd costed it out that it was $170 million cheaper to carry transport on rail than on road.
What are you hoping will come from a meeting today and this, I guess, hasn't started from today? There's been a lot of work before this meeting, but where do you hope to go from here?
I'm hoping that the people on the West Coast will realise that they can do something about the decline of population, they can do something about the lack of transport infrastructure, and they can do something to revive their declining football clubs. So when the football clubs are starting to amalgamate, the further and further West Coasters have to travel. It's nothing to travel 130 km for a football game. And if they don't do something now to revive their communities, then my question is, will there be football on the West Coast in 10 years? Because at the moment, there is no interest in investing in infrastructure on the West Coast that will revive communities. And that is what is needed, and that is what I'm fighting for.
Just to clarify, that inclusion of rail back onto the Eyre Peninsula, how would that help in getting sport continued on the Eyre Peninsula?
When rail was first introduced back in the 1930s, there was no issue about is it going to make money. It was on the basis that the government of the day had a vision for Eyre Peninsula. If they build the rail, the first station master at Woodner, Mr Hitchcock, went on to become a local farmer. There needed to be railway houses around the servicing the rail. As we know with Viterra, they need people to load the grain. And then you need the support services for those who live and work in the town. And that's how Eyre Peninsula began. That's how every single town along that railway line began. It began from nothing. It began from the investment in rail. So if you invest in rail, then that's going to open up not just your produce, your freight, but also it's going to open up tourism. And West Coast is one of the most beautiful places in the world. The tourists are already coming because of COVID. Coffin Bay sales are booming, and that's because people are starting to discover the West Coast, but there is no transport. There is no link to the national gauge, and that would open us up as a major tourist destination from people all over Australia.
Mari Shaw QC speaking with Brooke Neindorf there about her support for getting more rail back to the Eyre Peninsula. And the Country Hour will be broadcasting from the Eyre Peninsula for the rest of the week. We'll be in Ceduna tomorrow, then Kimber, Lucky Bay, and finally Port Augusta on Friday. So it'd be great if you could join me. Also, keep listening to your local radio because Sonia Feldhoff is on the way.
Cassie's on the road today.
You're on the road tomorrow.
I'll be on the road tomorrow too. There you go.
We're getting out and about,
aren't we? We're going to be talking first up, though, very much in the city, and that's about the New South Road Torrens to Darlington plans that have been released today. We'll talk to many along the corridor about their view on whether it's a good plan, whether it meets their expectations or not. And I guess over the weekend we saw Western Australia clamp shut the border to South Australians.
Somewhat expected.
14 days quarantine you'll need to do, so it's not quite, but it's essentially. Now we're just waiting to see if other states might follow suit. The Premier's worried about Queensland, Tasmania and Northern Territory. We'll see what we can expect
not
there.
Not over yet. Keep listening to ABC local radio. That's all we have time for, though. It is coming up to 1 o'clock, almost time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.